The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
Magnus Carnum is a principal at Left Lane Capital. Magnus established and heads up their European office. Agnes has led or co-led Left Lane investments in companies like GoStudent, WeTravel, and Masterworks. So Magnus, welcome to this week's episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
Thank you so much, Gary. I'm very glad to be here.
Likewise, glad to have you. So Left Lane has a unique approach to VC. You run your fund like a sales team, with each investor speaking to 25 plus companies every week. That gives you exposure to off the beaten track sectors as well as the hot and trendy sectors. So how does this approach help your team make more informed investment decisions and discover opportunities that other funds might overlook?
Look, Gary, I think every fund has their own approach and does what's worked for them. You know, some funds, they have a thesis around certain sectors or tend to cover seed investments from the top seed funds. And in our view, the startup world is a lot more varied than that, and good companies can come from anywhere and do not necessarily follow a certain path. And our conviction is, in order to have good coverage, in order to find the most attractive startups in the world, we need to have the relevant coverage of the markets, marketplace. And the way we do that is every analyst, associate, senior associate, et cetera, at Left Lane speaks to 20 to 30 companies a week. By the time that they recommend their first investment to the investment committee, they will probably have tracked 1,000 or so companies and will have been able to apply pattern matching to what companies do well, what companies do not tend to do well. NRLC on the other side, our investment committee, sees startups from hot sectors and from slightly overlooked sectors, and will find themselves looking at companies with high valuations because there is a lot of eyes on them, and companies that maybe aren't raising. And we're doing the data work for them, present ourselves as outside consultants, and ultimately break free an opportunity. And we found that plurality of tracking live rounds as well as tracking the best companies and freeing up rounds has yielded the best results for us in the past, and hence why we're applying that playbook into the future as well.
You've analyzed your portfolio companies to identify the traits of startups that scale from 1 million to 10 million ARR. What are your key findings?
There are certain parallelities in the most successful journeys. And I think the number one point I would like to mention here is the obsession with data. At the time that we invest in a company, a company typically has product market fit and knows roughly how much sales and marketing spend will lead into additional revenue and how that ratio roughly looks like. Where we see the magic happen is when the founders are open to laying the foundation of a data-centric company with world-class BI tools, and then sharing this data both with their key employees as well as with the investors, and invite feedback on how to run the company based on this data-driven approach.
And when you're looking at investing in a company, so before you can be absolutely sure that they're going to be doing the things, following the formula for success, how do you test ahead of time for these criteria, you know, data obsession? I know some of the other things you mentioned to me previously, goal setting, high talent bar, strong delegation orientation. How do you test and how do you satisfy yourself that they are going to be strong in each of those areas?
So the truth is, I think we analyze the company and the health of the company itself, and some of the obsession with data and how we measure that is, I think we're ourselves a bit obsessed with data. For every single investment, we pull the raw data and do a variety of different data cuts based on that revenue retention, usage retention. We play that back to the founder and have a discussion. with a management team on that. And that's typically when we see whether there is a DNA match on that regard. There's a few other things, as you rightly mentioned, that we found particularly successful post-investment, which is something that we can help with. Oftentimes, we come in as a first institutional investor in a company. And I think as long as the founders or the management team have the right DNA, we find that the right working relationship establishes over time. And what we always do is we share these best practices across our portfolio. And we hope that the majority of founders will ultimately work with us according to these principles, right? Another thing that we found works well is effective goal setting. Oftentimes, fundraising rounds can be good forcing functions for goal setting. So for example, if I lead a Series A investment, what I do right post the investment is I write down the equity story for the next fundraise. That doesn't mean that we necessarily need to fundraise, but it helps us to get the priorities aligned for the next 12, 18, 24 months. And then we start ticking off the boxes. And the good thing that happens here is there is a dialogue with the founder on what his or her priorities are. I can mirror back from what I would want to see to lead another round or what maybe the market would want to see. And then within that dialogue, we define the most important milestones for the company to hit over this time period. And interestingly, this then often trickles down to the organization in the form of OKRs, objective key results, and sort of that is a very popular tool that companies are using. We also invite the company to do that same thing bottoms up and then ultimately reconvene a few weeks later and agree on these goals. Again, I think running a company according to numbers-driven goals as much as possible is again something that we found yielded into a lot of success, as it really helps you prioritize the right things. And some of these things are not numbers-driven, right? Some of these things are, we need to hire XYZ. Numbers-driven thing there is just, by what date do we think this is reasonable? And then we reassess these things in real time.
And how about diversity? So many studies suggest that D&I is important for business success, and the tech sector is a pretty poor track record in diversity and inclusion. Do you believe diversity is a role to play in the recipe for startup success?
It certainly has a big role to play. I think where we start is in our own firm. We have a roughly 50-50 split between female and male investors and female and male people working at Leftlane. In the London office, as of Wednesday, I think we're actually more women than men. I've seen myself while working in McKinsey, who puts a lot of emphasis on diverse teams, that the magic happens when you have different perspectives that come from different genders, but maybe also different socioeconomic backgrounds and from what you've studied and whatever else it is. And it is really, I think, diversity that yields to the best outcomes. We can only ever act as an advisor on that topic. So for example, we can push diverse boards, we can push diverse management teams and advise the founders on these things. And it's something that is of big importance to us.
When you do your pattern matching, is diversity part of that or is it an adjunct to that?
I think where you're coming from is in an industry that historically has been very male dominated, applying pattern matching might be a dangerous thing. We have male and female founders and we found similar success or the same success. We haven't found much patterns that would suggest that the startup industry shouldn't be more diverse. I think we need to make a conscious effort to be open in terms of the upper funnel, to be speaking to opportunities wherever they come from. We're open for cold emails. We're not a fund that says we're only ever going to take intros from our network and it's the only way to reach us. I think vice versa, we're trying to reach out to every new company that's in the market. And so I think with that approach of not only tracking the investments from the top seed funds, but having a broader market coverage, I think we're allowing the startup ecosystem to become more diverse over time.
We've been talking mostly about success factors. Tell me about the mistakes that you've seen startups make that have hindered their trajectory, hindered their growth.
One thing that as Left Lane we're a bit more open to than other funds are a lot more open to. A lot of the enterprise software playbook or B2B playbook is around you're selling to small customers in the beginning because these are the most likely to adopt your product. Let's go up market as soon as possible. We invest at a stage where a company has product market fit and they have good unit economics selling into this particular sector. And so what we found sometimes go wrong is for founders who blindly follow this approach of trying to go for higher contract sizes, which ceteris paribus, of course, should be more efficient if you have the same number of salespeople and they sell bigger contracts. But what we found is that you can run formidable businesses targeting prosumer and SMB sectors. And we've also witnessed the journey of going up market many, many times, but doing this too quickly before you have product or feature parity or even pricing parity, it's dangerous to go up market too quickly. If you steer your sales team away from what's working into a new territory, into a new ICP, ideal customer profile, you're running the risk of going into way longer sales cycles. The feedback cycles for you to learn whether you're going to win this new account or not become way longer. And sometimes you end up losing a whole year if you steer away too much of your focus from your core customer segment. So going up market too early is something that we have seen cost a lot of money. Another thing here is scaling up a sales team before you have product market fit in a geography. There was a time in 2020, 2021 where blitz scaling was the new normal. And so if a company had product market fit in a certain geography, it was very en vogue to go into a new geography and scale before you had clear product market fit. Again, this can bring a lot of chaos in some ways into organizations because ultimately it is very expensive to retain this new 10, 15, 20 big sales team if only two of these sales reps are performing. And we're always, I think, analyzing each situation individually. I think there are some geographies where it's easier to expand into from certain geographies. And I think we have this local market knowledge in Europe and in the US and elsewhere. And then there are some geographies where it really needs founder attention in order for it to work. For example, the US, we've rarely seen it work to just hire one or two salespeople for a European company to go to the US. We typically see that it starts working when you have very senior management or even ideally founder attention on the topic. Another pitfall I've identified is going multi-product too fast. We've seen companies with fantastic NPS on their core product shift a lot of resources to new products before maybe having proven to be able to continue innovation on the existing product while steering most of the attention of the engineering team to the new products. And this is something that can ultimately reduce product velocity across the board and for competitors to catch up maybe to your core product, as opposed to staying ahead of the game in your core product that clearly works. And so, again, I think it is very much the assessment of where is your engineering team today? And do we feel that now is the right time to go multi-product? Or do we feel it's maybe worth waiting another 6 months until we have, you know, the world-class VP engineering in place that can actually oversee the sales team scaling while keeping the same output?
Sure. A world-class VP of sales, presumably, rather than VP engineering. Or do you think they need to have both in place at the same time?
There are two challenges with regards to this. I think one is developing a new product, if it's complex, that is, again, as market leading as the first one was, and then also selling it. And to the degree that the two products are just adjacent and not selling into the exact same customer persona, you will need even a new sales playbook in order to sell this product. And so I agree with you that I think by the time that a company is multi-product, you need to have both a world-class VP engineering and a world-class VP sales in place so that you can scale the processes.
Yeah, and probably a world-class VP of product as well, unless the VP engineering has the talent to do both. I'd like to switch the focus to investor pitches. You receive countless pitches from entrepreneurs and would-be entrepreneurs. Tell me about the things that typically set apart the more persuasive pitches. And maybe there's one particular pitch from a startup that you could walk us through that really blew you away.
The obvious one that comes to mind there is the pitch of Felix, the founder of GoStudent. I first met him about 4.5 years ago at a dinner that his seed investor, Speedinvest, was hosting. And it was intended as the dinner that was showcasing, inviting the top seed founders from their portfolios. So in any case, I would have spoken to every single founder, but there was this person, you know, at the corner of the room that was about 1.5 heads taller than the rest of folks. And he was building an online tutoring business, which is something that has been done before and that has failed in the past. However, the way that he was introducing the company was as him building the biggest school in the world. And it was a completely new spin on an old topic. And it was clear that this gentleman had a way better understanding of the education system and what was broken with it, and had a way better understanding of how to get this product to market and how to attract the best tutors on his platform, which ultimately will result and retain them, which ultimately will result into him being able to foster long-term relationships between tutors and students, which is something that every other online tutoring marketplace before him has struggled with. And so I ended up pushing his investment in my last venture firm that I was working for, and ultimately ended up co-investing with Leftlane in that company, which accidentally also was the first investment from Leftlane Fund One. And this is how I to the firm that I now work for.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I know that you have some views on the difference between VC in the States and Europe. European investors have been much slower to adopt VC in their portfolios than in the States. There's still a certain skepticism, especially in some parts of Europe, about the world of VC. What do you think could be done, should be done, to encourage European pension funds, European universities to embrace venture capital as one of their core asset classes?
Look, I think European venture is a fantastic asset class, and European investors, largely the public ones, are missing out on that value creation. And it's something that there are a lot of people ultimately creating awareness for this topic. But frankly, I think the more the merrier, right? In the US, universities and pension funds allocate a substantial portion of their capital to the private markets, private equity, and venture capital. In Europe, that's different. There's regulation that prohibits pension funds, and I think there is a culture that doesn't allow universities to invest in venture capital in the way that it's done in the US. And so ultimately that means that the money backing, especially later stage European startups, predominantly comes from US LPs. LPs are the ones that invest into venture funds. At Leftlane, we have a substantial share of the people that give us money that are European. However, we would love for that to be a larger share of pension funds, of universities, because we believe that value creation should ultimately be captured across the globe.
I'd like to get to the human side of investing. We focused a lot on OKRs and numbers, and everything sounded very data-driven. But there's obviously also a strong human element, both in terms of you and your colleagues and the teams you invest in. And when we last spoke, you mentioned how losing your father a year or so ago prompted you to embark on a journey of self-exploration. So I'm curious, where are you on that journey? How has that changed you as a person and maybe as an investor or a mentor or coach for your portfolios?
Look, Gary, I think that a VC has anywhere from 4 to 5 jobs. I'm a financial analyst when I'm diligencing companies. I'm a consultant when I'm trying to help companies. I'm a salesperson when I'm speaking to 25, 30 companies a week. And I'm a coach and mentor to the portfolio founders that I invest in. And I think especially on this latter part, in order to do a good job at that, I think I need to be in sync with myself. And I need to be in sync with myself per se, in any case. And after losing my father last year, I definitely felt that a deep emptiness inside me. And I hence went on a journey of self-healing, which I think peaked in a 1-week visit with the Hoffman Institute, basically going into my childhood, working through a few themes. And it's been incredibly impactful to my daily life. I started gratitude journaling, so writing down 3 things I appreciate about myself and 3 things I'm grateful for. I've started having a set morning routine. I've started setting boundaries for myself in order to be more effective and in order to be ultimately good with myself, but also good at what I do. Because the truth is that in venture capital, if you're very cynical about it, you're getting paid for 2 to 4 excellent decisions a year, right? Which is saying yes to the right companies. And I think being in tune with myself is a value per se, but also something which ultimately helps me be the best at what I do.
That's fascinating. And we'll share a link in the notes to the Hoffman Institute. How did you come across them? It sounds like you've got a lot out of that experience, but I'm wondering how you first came across them. Were you referred or did you just stumble across them?
I think it's indeed all word of mouth. So in the US, there are long waiting lists for this course, and in Europe, not so much. I was first introduced to it through a friend that had her dad go to the Hoffman Institute and sort of returning as a changed person. I frankly believe that I personally have a lot of work to do still. Not quite sure if I came back as a changed person and, you know, maybe linking some of the self-healing journey to the professional journey as I've just done, maybe showing some of that. But I think it was brought up 3-4 times in my friend circle. And ultimately, I decided that this was something that I was eager to explore for myself. And it even entails not being on your phone, on your laptop, not even reading a book for 7 full days at a time, which I think in itself is very healing, and I can highly recommend that to anyone. At the same time, I'm also reminded on a daily basis that it's very much the person, in this case, me, needing to want the change and needing to make it effective in their own lives, as opposed to just going to a course for a week and hoping that everything will change magically. It's very much a work in progress.
Yeah. And on this work in progress, what would you say so far is the most impactful change you've made? I mean, you mentioned a few things earlier, like the journaling and the boundary setting, but what's the most impactful thing in your life that you've adopted as a result of being on that Hoffman Institute week?
Something else that resonated, I will mention 2 more things that really resonated with me. One was visioning. Basically, in my head, going to the place where I see myself in the future and imagining in a very concrete way how this future is going to look like, what the smell is going to be, what the sounds are going to be like, what people will be around me, what nature will look like. This is helping me a lot, I think, in setting the right tone for the day and in seeing the North Star of where I'm ultimately going with everything I'm doing every day. The second thing I would like to mention is a technique called pre-cycling, which allows me to go into a situation in the future and then think about which of my patterns that might be negative patterns might be getting in my way of being my true self and of achieving maybe what I would like to get out of a meeting, for example. And then I can see coming what will basically be in between me and what I would like to achieve and what is my true self. Then there is a few techniques, which I'm happy to share in more detail with anybody that speaks to me about it, that help me get rid of that pattern in advance to being in the situation, which is something that I found very powerful. And in fact, I've done that for a few situations now, and every single time I've been able to show my true self as opposed to some self-protection mechanisms, which was really helpful.
Great. Well, I really appreciate you being so candid about your personal journey, as well as talking about some of the more, shall we say, corporate type topics. It's been fabulous having you on the show, learning all about the European VC sector. And I wish you and the team at Left Lane and your growing portfolio huge success in the next few years.
Thank you so much, Gary, and all the best for you as well.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.